close together, but when I looked on the map to research this show, they're not really that close.
One of the things about the signage is that a guy by the name Merle Harold was our sign guy. He started putting signs up when the trail was built, and there are so many different ways up there that it got to be sort of a joke that all trails on the south side of the district lead to Kentucky Falls. All roads go that way. So he had signs, you know, it could be 10 miles out. There were just signs everywhere that said that. Unfortunately, those signs get shot up and torn down and this, and people still get lost, especially if you come in from the BLM side up through Dunn Ridge Road.
When I was researching for the show, I looked up on the All Trails site, and there were a lot of comments from people that said, follow the directions that are written here on All Trails. Don't use your Google Maps because you will get lost.
There's been so many people that have gotten lost that descriptions have gotten better and better and better.
Today's show is part one of a two-part show. Be sure to tune in next week to pick up part two. Thanks to Pacifica Radio member stations for airing Beyond Your Front Door. And thanks to Oregon-based Jumpin' the Rails for performing the theme song, Smith Chapel, used on this show. And thanks again to all of you for tuning in. I hope you have a great week and get some time beyond your front door.
Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Radio in San Francisco. This is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, the explosive January 6th hearings on Trump's failed insurrection continue to break ground today. Also, Vice Chair Liz Cheney warns again against witness tampering by the Trump forces. And should Joe Biden run again? If not, why not? And who's the alternative? That's what Norman Solomon wants to ask you. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We broadcast every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network here in the Bay Area. And we are happy to have you along today. And just a moment or two, I'm going to play what I think are some of the significant parts of the hearings, particularly having to do with the testimony of, people who were a part of this vigilante operation and who have changed their mind a bit, shall we say. But I think the big story here, let me read you a little bit from the New York Times today. I believe this is from the Times. And this is sort of the smoking gun, almost, of Trump himself being the instigator. Just read a little bit. President Donald Trump planned to lead a march to the Capitol on January 6th, but wanted it to look like a spontaneous decision, people involved in the plans told the committee investigating the mob violence election violence. According to documents obtained from the National Archives, Mr. Trump reviewed a tweet that said, quote, "I will be making a big speech at 10 a.m. on January 6th at the Ellipse south of the White House. Please arrive early. Massive crowds expected. March to the Capitol after Stop the Steal." The tweet was never sent, but Trump let his allies know in advance that his plan was to direct the crowd to the Capitol, and it is acknowledged in the paperwork that Trump saw this email. So even if he didn't write it, sometimes he didn't write his own he couldn't write his own tweets. This one showed that he had viewed it. So he was number one instigator. We all knew this. We all heard him say, "We're all going to march to the kill," all that kind of stuff. We know that now. Anyway, I wanted to play for you some of the testimony today from the Oath Keepers. I wanted you to hear who these people are. I think we need to know who and what we're up against. It just so happens these folks sort of changed their mind in midstream, if you will. Not totally. I wouldn't say they're sort of reformed. But it is very interesting to hear these two guys talk about their relationship to this movement, because this is what we're up against. So here, this starts out, I believe, with the chairman.
We're joined today by Mr. Jason Van Tatenhove and Mr. Stephen Ayers. Mr. Tatenhove is an artist and journalist. He's a former spokesman of the Oath Keepers and a former close associate of Elmer Stuart Rhodes, the founder and president of the Oath Keepers, who has been charged with seditious conspiracy in relation to the Capitol attack. Mr. Van Tatenhove broke with the Oath Keepers and has since spoken out forcefully against the violent group. Mr. Ayers is a former supporter of President Trump. He answered the president's call to come to Washington, D.C. on January 6th. He marched to the Capitol on the president's orders. He pleaded guilty last month to disorderly and disruptive conduct at the Capitol. Mr. Ayers, who no longer supports President Trump, came forward voluntarily to share his story as a warning. I will now swear in our witnesses. The witnesses will please stand and raise their right hand. Do you swear or affirm under the penalty of perjury that the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Thank you. You may be seated. Let the record reflect that the witnesses answered in the affirmative. I recognize myself for questions. Today we've discussed how President Trump summoned an angry mob of supporters to Washington, D.C., many of whom came prepared to do battle against police and politicians alike. We're fortunate enough to be joined by two witnesses who can help us understand who was in the mob that day. Both hardcore violent extremists like the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys and average Trump supporters swept up in the fervor of the day. Mr. Van Tatenhove, can you help us understand who the Oath Keepers are?
I can, thank you. My time with the Oath Keepers began back at Bundy Ranch with that first standoff when I went to cover them as an independent journalist. I then subsequently covered two more standoffs, the Sugar Pine Mine standoff and the White Hope Mine standoff. It was at that time that I was offered a job as national media director and an associate editor for the webpage. So I spent a few years with the Oath Keepers, and I can tell you that they may not like to call themselves a militia, but they are. They're a violent militia, and they are largely Stuart Rhodes. I think, rather than try to use words, I think the best illustration for what the Oath Keepers are happened January 6th, when we saw that stacked military formation going up the stairs of our Capitol. I saw radicalization that started with my beginning of my time with them and continued over a period of time as the member base and who it was that Stuart Rhodes was courting drifted further and further right into the alt-right world, into white nationalists, and even straight-up racists. And it came to a point where I could no longer continue to work for them. But the Oath Keepers are a dangerous militia that is in large part fed by the ego and drive of Stuart Rhodes, who at times seemed to see himself as this paramilitary leader. I think that drove a lot of it. So, in my opinion, the Oath Keepers are a very dangerous organization.
Well, thank you very much. You've talked a little bit about that danger. So, what is the Oath Keepers' vision for America? And why should Americans be concerned about it?
I think we saw a glimpse of what the vision of the Oath Keepers is on January 6th. It doesn't necessarily include the rule of law. It doesn't necessarily include, it includes violence. It includes trying to get their way through lies, through deceit, through intimidation, and through the perpetration of violence, the swaying of people who may not know better through lies and rhetoric and propaganda that can get swept up in these moments. And I'll admit I was swept up at one point as well, too. But I don't know if that answers the question.
Well, it does. And you talk about being swept up. So at what point did you break with the Oath Keepers?
There came a point, there were many red flags, and I probably should have broke with them much earlier than I did. But the straw that broke the camel's back really came when I walked into a grocery store. We were living up in the very remote town of Eureka, Montana, and there was a group of core members of the group of the Oath Keepers and some associates, and they were having a conversation at that public area where they were talking about how the Holocaust was not real. And that was, for me, something I just could not abide. And you know, we were not wealthy people at all. We were barely surviving, and it didn't matter. I went home to my wife and my kids, and I told them that I've got to walk away at this point. I don't know how we're going to survive or where we're going to go or what we're going to do, but I just can no longer continue and put in my resignation.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ayers, there were many people in the crowd that day, January 6th, including you, who are not part of an extremist group. I'd like to start by having you tell the American people a little bit about yourself. Can you tell us about your life before January 6th?
Basically nothing but a family man and a working man. Worked at the company, a cabinet company up in Northeast Ohio for going on 20 years. Family's my life. I was a supervisor there, so that took up a lot of my other, a lot of my free time. Other than that, I'm with my family, camping, playing basketball, playing games with my son.
Just what any ordinary American citizen, family man would do.
Yep, exactly.
So this committee has reviewed thousands of hours of surveillance footage from January 6th. During this review, we identified you entering the Capitol, as we see in this video. Mr. Ayers, why did you decide to come to Washington on January 6th?
For me personally, I was, pretty hardcore into the social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. I followed, President Trump, on all of the websites, he basically put out, come to Stop the Steal rally, and I felt like I needed to be down here.
So you basically learned about the rally on social media and at some point made a decision to come to Washington.
Yep. I had some friends I found out were coming down, and I just hopped on with them right at the tail end when I found out and came down here with them.
Thank you very much. The chair recognizes the vice chair, Ms. Cheney of Wyoming, for any questions she may have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Ayers, when you entered the Capitol last year, did you believe that the election had been stolen?
At that time, yeah. Everything that I was seeing online, I definitely believed that that's exactly what that was the case.
And when you heard from President Trump that the election was stolen, how did that make you feel?
Oh, I was very upset, as were most of his supporters. That's basically what got me to come down here.
And do you still believe the election was stolen?
Not so much now. I got away from all the social media when January 6th happened. Basically deleted it all. I started doing my own research and everything. And for me, for something like that to be that, to actually take place, it's too big. There's no way you can keep something like that quiet, as big as something like that. With all the, all the lawsuits being shot down one after another, that was mainly what convinced me.
Well, I think that's very important. And we've also talked about today and in previous hearings the extent to which the president himself was told that the election hadn't been stolen by his Justice Department, by his White House counsel, by his campaign. Would it have made a difference to you to know that President Trump himself had no evidence of widespread fraud?
Oh, definitely. Who knows? I may not have come down here then,
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Gentlelady yields back. Chair recognizes the gentlewoman from Florida, Ms. Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Earlier today we showed how Donald Trump's December 19th tweet summoned both extremist groups as well as rank and file supporters of President Trump to come to Washington, D.C., average Americans. He told them to, quote, be there, we'll be wild, and they came. We showed how President Trump repeatedly told them, fight, 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 and they marched to the Capitol. Mr. Ayers, you were in that crowd at the rally and then the crowd that marched to the Capitol. When you arrived on the Ellipse that morning, were you planning on going to the Capitol?
No, we didn't actually plan to go down there. You know, we went basically to see the Stop the Steal rally, and that was it.
So why'd you decide to march to the Capitol?
Well, basically, you know, the president, you know, got everybody riled up, told everybody to head on down. So we basically were just following what he said.
After the president's speech, as you're marching down to the Capitol, how did you feel?
I was, you know, I'm angry, you know, after everything that was basically said in the speech. You know, a lot of the stuff he said, he already put out in tweets. A lot of, I've already seen it and heard it before. So, I mean, I was already worked up, and so were most of the people there.
So as you started marching, did you think there was still a chance the election would be overturned?
Yeah, at that time I did, you know, because everybody was kind of like in the hope that, you know, Vice President Pence was not going to certify the election. You know, also the whole time on our way down there, we kept hearing about this big reveal. I remember us talking about, and we kind of thought maybe that was it. So that hope was there.
Did you think that the president would be marching with you?
Yeah, I think everybody thought he was going to be coming down. You know, he said in his speech, you know, kind of like he's going to be there with us. So, I mean, I think I believed it.
I understand. We know that you illegally entered the Capitol that afternoon and then left the Capitol area later on. What made you decide to leave?
Basically, when President Trump put his tweet out, we literally left right after that come out. You know, to me, if he would have done that earlier in the day, 1:30, I, you know, we wouldn't be in this, maybe wouldn't be in this bad of a situation or something.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Chair recognizes the gentleman from Maryland, Mr. Raskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Van Tatenhoff, in the run-up to January 6, Stuart Rhodes publicly implored President Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act, the 1807 law that allows the president to call up militias to put down a rebellion against the United States. And I want to get your thoughts about this in the context of your prior relationship with Stuart Rhodes. I understand that you had conversations with Rhodes about the Insurrection Act. Why was he so fixated on that? And what did he think it would enable the Oath Keepers to do?
Well, I think it gave him a sense of legitimacy, that it was a path forward to move forward with his goals and agendas. I think we need to quit mincing words and just talk about truths. And what it was going to be was an armed revolution. I mean, people died that day. Law enforcement officers died this day. There was a gallows set up in front of the Capitol. This could have been the spark that started a new civil war, and no one would have won there. That would have been good for no one. He was always looking for ways to legitimize what he was doing, whether by wrapping it in the trappings of it's not a militia, it's a community preparedness team. We're not a militia, we're an educational outreach group. It's a veteran support group. But again, we've got to stop with this dishonesty and the mincing of words and just call things for what they are. You know, he's a militia leader. He had these grand visions of being a paramilitary leader. And the Insurrection Act would have given him a path forward with that. You know, the fact that the president was communicating, whether directly or indirectly, messaging, you know, kind of that gave him the nod. And all I can do is thank the gods that things did not go any worse that day.
What did the Oath Keepers see in President Trump?
They saw a path forward that would have legitimacy. They saw opportunity, I think, in my opinion, to become a paramilitary force, you know?
Last week, the Department of Justice indicated that it has evidence of the Oath Keepers bringing not just firearms, but explosives to Washington ahead of January 6th. And the committee's also learned that Stuart Rhodes stopped to buy weapons on his way to Washington and shipped roughly $7,000 worth of tactical gear to a January 6th rally planner in Virginia before the attack. Did you ever hear Rhodes discuss committing violence against elected political leaders?
Yeah, I mean, that went back from the very beginning of my tenure. One of the first assignments that he brought to me, wanting me to do as more of a graphic artist function, was to create a deck of cards. You may remember back to the conflict in the Middle East, where our own military created a deck of cards, which was a who's who of kind of the key players on the other side that they wanted to take out. And Stuart was very intrigued by that notion and influenced by it, I think. And he wanted me to create a deck of cards that would include different politicians, judges, including up to Hillary Clinton as the Queen of Hearts. This is a project that I refused to do. But from the very start, we saw that. There was always the push for military training, including there were courses in that community that went over explosives training. So, yeah, this all falls in line.
Mr. Vantanoff, you say in your very thoughtful written testimony that we received today that you fear what the next election cycle will bring. And you also say that we have been exceedingly lucky in that we have not seen more bloodshed so far. I wonder if you would elaborate on those two statements.
I think as far as the luck goes, we've had the potential from Bundy Ranch on. I mean, being boots on the ground at these standoffs, and they were standoffs where there were firearms pointed across lines at federal law enforcement agencies, you know, whatever it may be with that particular standoff. But I think we've gotten exceedingly lucky that more bloodshed did not happen, because the potential has been there from the start. And we got very lucky that the loss of life was, and as tragic as it is, that we saw on January 6th, the potential was so much more. Again, all we have to look at is the iconic images of that day with the gallows set up for Mike Pence, for the Vice President of the United States. You know, and I do fear for this next election cycle, because who knows what that might bring if a president that's willing to try to instill and encourage to whip up a civil war amongst his followers using lies and deceit and snake oil, and regardless of the human impact. What else is he going to do if he gets elected again? All bets are off at that point. And that's a scary notion. I have three daughters. I have a granddaughter. And I fear for the world that they will inherit if we do not start holding these people to account.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Vantatenhoff. Mr. Ayers, I first want to ask you about what finally caused you to leave on January the 6th? We know that the medieval-style combat with our police, the occupation of the building, this was going on for several hours until the president issued at 4:17 a tweet, I believe, that included a video telling people to go home. Did you see that, and did that have any effect on what you were doing?
Well, when we were there, as soon as that come out, everybody started talking about it, and it seemed like it started to disperse, you know, some of the crowd. Obviously, you know, once we got back to the hotel room, we seen that it was still going on, but it definitely dispersed a lot of the crowd.
And did you leave at that point?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we left.
So, in other words, that was the key moment when you decided to leave, when President Trump told people to go home.
Yeah, we left right when that came out.
You were not a member of an organized group like the Oath Keepers or the Proud Boys, as most of the crowd wasn't. I wonder, on January 6th, Was it your view that these far-right groups like the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys and Three Percenters and others were on your side? Did you have any reservations about marching with them and rallying with them?
Well, I definitely didn't have a problem. You know, I was probably following them online myself. You know, I thought, you know, hey, they're on our team, good. That's how I kind of looked at it at the time. You know, like, I didn't have a problem with it. I thought it was a good thing.
I'm interested in hearing about what's happened to you since the events of January 6th. You told the vice chair that you no longer believe Trump's big lie about the election, but that's what brought you originally to Washington. Looking back on it now, how do you reflect on the role that you played in the crowd that day and what is going on in your life?
Basically, you know, I lost my job. Since this all happened, you know, pretty much sold my house. So everything that happened with the charges, you know, thank God, a lot of them did get dismissed because I was just holding my phone, but at the same time I was there. So, I mean, it definitely changed my life, you know, and not for the good, definitely not for the, you know, for the better. That's all I could say.
President Trump is still promoting the big lie about the election. How does that make you feel?
It makes me mad because I was hanging on every word he was saying. Everything he was putting out, I was following it. I mean, if I was doing it, hundreds of thousands or millions of other people are doing it, or maybe even still doing it. It's like he just said about that. You know, you got people still following and doing that. Who knows what the next election could come out? You know, could end up being down the same path we are right now. I mean, just don't know.
Mr. Ayers, I see that your wife has joined you today, and welcome to Washington. We know this has been very difficult on you both and your family. What lessons, finally, do you want the American people to learn from the way you and your family have suffered as a result of these events?
Biggest thing is I consider myself a family man and I love my country. And I don't think any one man is bigger than either one of those. I think that's what needs to be taken. You know, people dive into the politics, and for me, I felt like I had, you know, like horse blinders on. I was locked in the whole time. Biggest thing for me is take the blinders off. Make sure you step back and see what's going on before it's too late.
Well, I want to thank you for your testimony and for appearing, both of you, today. And Mr. Chairman, I yield back to you.
And you're listening to excerpts from today's hearings from the January 6th investigation. Very powerful stuff. Let's listen to Liz Cheney now. She once again warned Trump and his forces of that witness intimidation would not be tolerated. Listen to this.
After our last hearing, President Trump tried to call a witness in our investigation, a witness you have not yet seen in these hearings. That person declined to answer or respond to President Trump's call and instead alerted their lawyer to the call. Their lawyer alerted us, and this committee has supplied that information to the Department of Justice. Let me say one more time, we will take any effort to influence witness testimony very seriously. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
And this appears to be, it appears to be a direct attempt at intimidation by Trump forces to a key witness. So that tells me that the Trumpians are getting pretty nervous. It is looking ugly for the fake billionaire, but who knows what is going to happen. We're going to take a short musical break here on Flashpoints. We're going to continue the discussion with Harvey Wasserman, and we're also going to talk about some bad news around the nuclear front and the refusal to shut down very dangerous reactors in this country. Stay with us. Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Thanks, Mike, for the good music. We always appreciate that. Dealing with these issues, it's nice to have some powerful music behind us. We're going to keep talking about the hearings, and we're also going to talk about this nuclear. It's a disaster in its own right, but it could lead to a much bigger disaster. Welcome back, Harvey Wasserman. Harvey Wasserman is a longtime solar energy advocate, anti-nuclear activist, voter protection frontline sort of guy. Welcome back to Flashpoints. I'm happy to say I participate every Monday in these wonderful election protection gatherings that are a lot more than just straight ahead election discussions, but that's important as well. Harv, it is interesting that the hearings ended again, again with a bit of a bombshell. Here comes Liz Cheney out of the corner, warning apparently Trump directly to not threaten a future witness. Apparently the witness contacted the witness's attorney, the attorney contacted the committee. Your thoughts, have you been following the hearings? Clearly,
I watched hearings.
It's worth looking at. Go on.
It's just, I'm just glued to the tube to watch these hearings. It's spectacular. Very clearly, the Democrats have finally got their act together on something, and the hearings have made it very clear that Donald Trump consciously, and they just went off, consciously summoned a fascist mob to take over the U.S. government. This is an attempted coup d'etat, and you know, they came very close to actually overthrowing the government of the United States with the express leadership of Donald Trump. Donald Trump, in the last hearing, made very clear he wanted to personally go to the Capitol and personally lead an armed mob to kill, if necessary, the Vice President of the United States. God knows what would have happened if they got their hands on AOC or Nancy Pelosi. You know, I see a real parallel with the nuclear power issue. We have a governor here in this state who is ramrodding legislation through the assembly to keep open two nuclear power plants that are a clear and present danger to the entire population of California and of the United States, because we are upwind of the whole country. You know, and I live in Los Angeles. A radioactive cloud from Diablo Canyon come down into Los Angeles within 5 hours, and do more devastation than we've ever seen in human history. It's a real parallel to what's going on in Washington, because the Assembly now has legislation to completely ignore all the environmental and all the safety regulations that we've seen at Diablo Canyon and just throw them out the window to keep these two reactors operating. It is as big a threat to the future of our health and safety on this planet as January 6th was to our democracy.
All right, well, and again, for people who are not familiar with this struggle, which has been going on, and for people who live outside the state, just very briefly, set it up again. You're making some powerful declarations about how dangerous it is. What do we know about that? And in terms of a time frame, is it dangerous now, in 5 years, in 20 years? Talk to us about that.
These two reactors, Dennis, are surrounded by at least a dozen earthquake faults, four of which are known to be active. It is also 45 miles from the San Andreas, which is half the distance that the ground zero was in the earthquake that destroyed the four reactors at Fukushima. Those reactors could be destroyed at any moment. They opened in the 1980s. The reactors are now pushing 40 years old. They are riddled with structural problems that we know about and with deferred maintenance that opens us up to structural problems that we don't know about. We petitioned Governor Newsom 3 years ago to have an independent inspection. We have more than 2,500 signatures from Californians, including Jane Fonda, Martin Sheen, people from Hollywood, simply asking the governor to inspect these reactors, and he wouldn't do it. And now he's turning around and saying, we need to keep these reactors open. They've been on a shutdown path, Dennis. There was a general agreement, a signed formal legal agreement between the town, the unions, the people of the area, the environmental groups, the legislature, the PUC, and the governor, in 2016 to shut these two reactors in 2024. We have been on a glide path to a sane, reasonable, smooth shutdown of the two reactors at Diablo Canyon for 6 years, including the retirement of the workforce and phase out of maintenance, and they're in violation of state law in terms of a cooling system for good reason. And now the governor and the assembly wants to waltz in and say, none of that matters. We're going to keep these two reactors open. And if there's an earthquake, God forbid, that turns these reactors into rubble, there is no private insurance. And nobody listening here can drive a car in California with private insurance, but they can operate two nuclear power plants that can absolutely destroy this state, and they can't get private insurance. And now the governor wants to let them...
Why can't they get private insurance for this? I guess they refer to this as like the new clean energy, but why can't they get private insurance for this new clean energy that they want to jam down our throats again and create sort of stimulate two more... you have to call these things sort of nuclear weapons waiting to happen.
They are nuclear engines of mass destruction. Getting private insurance for atomic reactors first became an issue in the 1950s. And the industry kept promising and promising that the technology would be so safe that in 15 years or whenever it was going to be, they would have private insurance. That was in the late 1950s. We're now more than a half century later, and they are still unable to get private insurance in case of a major meltdown. Anybody listening who owns a house, look at your homeowner's insurance. There is an explicit exclusion from any liability for a major atomic reactor accident. And so in the very sane and orderly manner in 2016, you know, all the major parties, except for the Mothers of Peace, which stayed out. They wanted the reactor shut immediately. But the major parties agreed to have a sane, slow, tempered phase out and shutdown of these two reactors. And now Governor Newsom waltzes in with the nuclear industry and says, no, no, none of that mattered. They're doing this without hearings, without a public vote, without any kind of informational discussion about what's really going on with these atomic reactors. And really, you're hearing a big sort of vague discussion about the so-called benefits and dangers of nuclear power. It doesn't matter. What matters is these two pieces of equipment. And they are more than 30 years old. I'm sure many of your listeners, Dennis, are driving 30, 40-year-old automobiles. There's a reason you take these things off the road. And Diablo Canyon is a dinosaur that is incredibly unsafe. And the idea that they could be prolonged in their operation even to 2024 and 5, but now beyond, with a dictatorial decree from the governor who's ignoring...
Well, I'll tell you something, Harv. San Luis Obispo is a very, very one of the most beautiful places in the world now. At the moment.
Well, it'll be
except for those two stacks.
God forbid, the worst case scenario, which is all too likely, it'll be Chernobyl again. It'll be, you'll have wild wolves running through radioactive community that's been abandoned, like Pripyat. We are looking here at 12 earthquake faults, 4 of them known to be active around a nuclear plant. And they say, oh, we can count on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The site inspector for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Dr. Michael Peck, long ago wrote a report saying those reactors should be shut because we cannot guarantee that they will hold up in an earthquake. And they shipped him off to Siberia and continue to ignore his findings. The governor should be ashamed and terrified simultaneously of what he's doing here.
All right, listen, we're out of time. How do people get more information? How would you like them to lock arms with you in this fight?
Well, the major group is the Mothers for Peace in San Luis Obispo. They have kept the faith for 50 years. You can write me directly, solartopia@gmail.com, and you can call the governor and call your state reps and senators and tell them, what are you doing? This makes January 6th look like small potatoes, because God forbid something should happen at Diablo Canyon. We are all basically dead. And, we have seen Chernobyl, Fukushima. Why do we need to see it here in California?
Well, I have no answer for that one. I want to thank you always, Harvey Wasserman. I want to recommend again, we're going to just for one moment, we're going to come back to those election protection weeklies. How do people participate? If they want to get together with a group between 80 and 100 people that meets every week, trying to strategize in terms of how to take back control of elections, how do they do that, Harv?
Write me directly, solartopia@gmail.com, solartopia@gmail.com. And if you do that, I'll send you a free PDF of my People's Spiral of U.S. History, which talks a lot about the mutant history of these horrible nuclear plants. Thank you so much, Dennis. Right. You're always great.
All right. Be safe. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with Norman Solomon. We're going to talk about whether it's a good idea for Joe Biden to run again. They are. The Democrats are reminding us that Biden's still towering over popularity in comparison to Trump. Biden at 43%, Trump at 41%. What do you think? We'll be right back. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is Dennis Bernstein. Let me read you this release from Roots Action that came out yesterday, I believe, declaring that President Biden has been neither bold nor inspiring, and his prospects for winning re-election appear to be bleak. The national activist organization Roots Action announced today that it will launch a campaign to prevent his renomination. That's a bold step. Joining us to talk about this is co-founder of Roots Action, Norman Solomon. He's a good friend of the show. Norman, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Hi, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you back with us. Do you think this is a good idea to sort of go at Biden now? Can't you hear all those Democrats saying you're out of your freaking mind, given what the alternative is?
It's an odd situation, because the polling very clearly, and the New York Times published the latest yesterday, shows the strong majority of Democrats in this country do not want Joe Biden to run for re-election. So what RootsAction.org is doing is putting into motion actual action that fulfills the desires of most registered Democrats in the United States. We have two real, I think, huge imperatives. One is to defeat the Republican Party and prevent really what is a neo-fascist party from gaining control of the White House out of the 2024 election. And the other is to move forward a progressive agenda. So any, I think, cogent analysis, just measured by the polling enthusiasm for Biden among Democrats, would tell us he is a logjam. We've got to get the Biden logjam out of the way so we have a chance to prevent a Republican takeover of the executive branch.
You know, it just seems there are so many challenges on that road. I mean, I guess we face them anyway. But, Norman, we see all kinds of things going on. And at the core is the real, effective, organized right wing that has been working for years to seize control of this country by taking over the local institutions. Is there time to change, or are you saying that we have no choice because Biden's a loser?
Well, Biden, from all indications, would be a loser. Nobody has a crystal ball, but defending the status quo, an incumbent president is the epitome of symbolizing the status quo, is a loser when you have this enormous disruption of the society. We have tremendous inflation. We have so many ills, and people generally are unhappy. The polling about wrong direction of the country is very high. One of the big reasons Hillary Clinton lost in 2016 is she symbolized the status quo. And we desperately need a Democratic Party presidential candidate in 2024 who does not symbolize, represent the status quo. That means we need to organize now and be proactive, because if we simply let the power brokers have their way, Biden, if he's to be taken at his word, intends to run again. And I think that would be a disaster for the Democratic Party and for democracy, especially because it would really be a help to either Trump or some other Republican lunatic who would be the GOP nominee.
And just structurally speaking, do you have real problems with the policy as it comes from Trump? I mean, obviously, we've been reporting on the disasters, multiple disasters at the border. A lot going on, but, who's out there? Who, if not Biden, who?
Well, the first step is to get Biden the logjam out of the way, because there is no who unless Biden is getting out of the way, has gotten out of the way if he's not pushed out of the way. The statement we released yesterday, and people can read it and sign up in support at don'trunjoe.org, the statement says the shortcomings, the failures of the Biden administration must not be denied, and they can't be used as an excuse to sit out the midterm elections. We need to fight this Republican Party, which is so extreme, has so many fascist characteristics. So Roots Action has a very strong position. We don't believe in Dem exit. We don't believe that people should just say, oh, the Democratic Party isn't good enough for me, so I'm going to vote for a party that gets 1% or 2%. That is a gift to the neo-fascists and the Republicans. We believe we should fight like hell to get the best possible Democratic nominees, and then we defeat Republicans. That's really a responsibility.
But, Norman, again, let me focus the question. What about the loss? I mean, and I'm speaking to the same problem that you are, but the Dems gave it up. They didn't see what was going on here. 10, 20, 30 years, again, the way in which the right wing seized control of key institutions that have everything to do with voting. Can we have a fair vote to support a candidate who we might care about? I mean, this is a big part of the struggle, isn't it?
Absolutely. Voting rights, civil rights, in so many different ways. We heard, though, in 2008, that there's no way that the system would allow Barack Obama to be elected. I don't think fatalism is where it's at. Skepticism and willingness to fight, as Gramsci said, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will, that's absolutely essential. The base, the grassroots, is how we make change. It's been true, as you know, Dennis, and you've been airing on the airwaves for more than 30 years now, at least, I think, about grassroots organizing is the only way we get any positive changes done. So if we just leave it to the party elites to say who should get the oil on his or her head to run for president or any office, it slides more and more into militarism, into xenophobia, and into the kind of policies that we're getting all too often out of the Fed.
Let's just say there are 10,000 people listening to this show that would like to support your vision and learn more about Roots Action and really get involved. What should these 10,000 people do?
Well, you can go to rootsaction.org and take 30 seconds to sign up for Action Bulletins. If you're particularly interested in the need to get Joe Biden as the logjam out of the way, you can also take another 30 seconds and go to the website don'trunjoe.org. That's don'trunjoe.org. And if you do that, you're going to be part of a network, more than a million people through rootsaction.org and a growing number at don'trunjoe.org, who are going to organize in the weeks and months ahead, first to get Biden out of the way, first to discourage him. We've had major coverage of this launch in the Washington Post and Politico and elsewhere in the last 24 hours. But the main thing is to organize at the grassroots, especially for pressure from the early states, the early primary states, so that Biden doesn't think he's going to have a cakewalk, that he realizes that this is not going to fly. And I think many listeners, and certainly you and I, Dennis, are old enough to remember 1967, when it seemed certain that President Johnson, of course he's going to be the Democratic nominee in 1968. But people organized like hell. They built an anti-war movement. There was a courageous candidate named Eugene McCarthy. He went to New Hampshire when the media and the political elites were laughing at him. And by the end of the winter, early in 1968, Lyndon Johnson, some people call it an abdication, but he announced he wouldn't run again. I think that if we could organize effectively, we have an excellent chance to force Biden out so that he does not go on the ticket in 2024. That opens up the possibility for somebody who is far better than him.
All right. We have about 3 minutes left, and I have to take these final 3 minutes, Norman, to ask you your thoughts on the current state of investigations, Trump's state, fascist emergence of almost a dictatorship last round, possible one coming up. But your thoughts on what's going on now? You think Trump is going down here? Does it matter?
Well, I think Trump, I think it does matter. Him as a cult of personality, Mussolini was a cult, Hitler for that matter was a cult. It does matter. And these hearings, while I was skeptical, I think these congressional hearings have been very illuminating, very important.
Yes.
And it's essential to get the education and agitation out there in the public to, if possible, take Trump out of the running. But clearly, whether it's DeSantis out of Florida or somewhere else, there are many other demagogues who want to have Trumpism survive, even if Trump isn't on the ticket. So I believe we really have to have a dual-track simultaneous policy to fight for progressive issues, for progressive causes, and also be anti-fascist. And that means that progressives should insist that we've got to, when November comes around, defeat Republicans.
Amazing. Okay, that's the voice of Norman Solomon. He is an amazing human being. He has been a wonderful reporter, media critic, many things. He is co-founder of Roots Action and doing great work for the people. Thanks, Norman. Appreciate the time.
Thank you, Dennis.
All right, stay safe. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and I just want to tell you, just in case I forgot to tell you, it is an amazing privilege to broadcast to you over these free speech, no holds barred, truth to power radio waves, the Pacifica Radio Network, the one remaining non-corporate radio network in this country, and we are happy to do this work for you, the listener. Stay tuned.